We're going back to the podium there in Tampa to hear Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina.
So, President Obama, with all due respect, don't tell me that my parents didn't build their business. Almost 45 years after my parents first became Americans, I stand before you and them tonight as the proud governor of South Carolina. We build things in the Palmetto State. We build planes, we build cars. We have three of the four largest tire producers in the world and are about to become the number one tire producing state in the country. And not too long ago, the Wall Street Journal said anyone still thinking the U.S. has lost its manufacturing chops hasn't been to South Carolina. We have so much potential and so much to be proud of. But like so many states, we have our challenges. Whether they be unemployment or education or poverty. And like so many of my governors, I work day in and day out to try and improve the lives of the people of my state. And sadly, the hardest part of my job continues to be this federal government, this administration, and this president. As I said, my parents loved it when they came to America. If you worked hard, the only things that could stop you were the limits you placed on yourself. Unfortunately, these past few years, you can work hard, try to be as successful as possible, follow the rules. And President Barack Obama will do everything he can to stand in your way. South Carolina recently passed one of the most innovative illegal immigration laws in the country. What did this president, who has failed to secure our borders and address this issue in any meaningful way, do? He sued us. If this president refuses to secure our borders, refuses to protect our citizens from the dangers of illegal immigration, then states have to take it upon ourselves. We said in South Carolina that if you have to show a picture ID to buy Sudafed, if you have to show a picture ID to set foot on an airplane, then you should have to show picture ID to protect the one of the most valuable, most central, sacred rights and blessed within America, the right to vote.
From NPR News, you are listening to live special coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention.
And what happened? President Obama stopped us. And now we come to the most unbelievable of them all. In 2009, South Carolina was blessed to welcome a great American company that chose to stay in our country to continue to do business. That company was Boeing. Boeing started a new line for their 787 Dreamliner, creating 1,000 new jobs in South Carolina, giving our state a shot in the arm when we truly needed it. At the same time, they expanded their job numbers in Washington State by 2,000. Not a single person was hurt by their decision, not one. And what did President Obama and his National Labor Relations Board do? They sued this iconic American company. It was shameful and not worthy of the promise of America. But we did one of the things we do best in South Carolina. We got loud. We're fighters in South Carolina, and as we fought, we watched an amazing thing happen. You fought with us. And guess what? We won. A few months ago, I sat on the tarmac at the Boeing facility in North Charleston and watched as a new Mac Daddy plane rolled onto the runway. sporting a Made with Pride in South Carolina decal and surrounded by, get ready for it, 6,000 non-union employees cheering, smiling, and so proud of what they had built. We deserve a president who won't sacrifice American jobs and American workers to pacify the bullying union bosses he counts as his political allies. American businesses deserve a federal government that doesn't stand in their way, not one that tries to chase them overseas. Sliding American ingenuity and innovation, that's what this president has meant to South Carolina. That's what this president has meant to this governor. And that's why this governor will not stop fighting until we send him home, back to Chicago, and send Mitt and Ann Romney to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I have had the pleasure of knowing Mitt Romney for several years now, and there is so much to appreciate about him. He fixes things. He's results-driven. He's taken broken companies and made them successful. He took a failing Olympics and made it a source of pride for our country. He went into a democratic state, cut taxes, brought in jobs, and improved education. Oh, and by the way, he actually balanced his budget. This is a man at peace with who he is, with the challenges he faces, and with what he intends to accomplish. This is a man not just a candidate looking to win an election, but a leader yearning to return our nation to its greatest potential. And this is a man who has a silver bullet, his greatest asset by far, the next First Lady of the United States, Ann Romney. Anne is the perfect combination of strength and grace. She does what so many women in America do. She balances in an exceptional way. She raised five amazing boys, battled MS, is a breast cancer survivor, and through it all, was a true partner to Mitt. Anne Romney makes all women proud by the way she has conducted her life as a strong woman of faith, as a mother, as a wife, and as a true patriot. She's an amazing inspiration for me and for so many women across the country. Not too long ago, I traveled to Michigan to campaign for the Romneys. Towards the end of the day, two self-described independents came up to me and said, "We like what we hear about Governor Romney. And although we don't know everything about him, what we do know, without a doubt, is that we deserve better than what we have today." They are so right. We deserve a president who will turn our economy around. We deserve a president who will balance our budget. We deserve a president who will reform and protect our retirement programs for future generations. We deserve a president who will fight for American companies, not against them. We deserve a president who will strengthen our military, not destabilize them. America deserves better than what we have today. We deserve a President Mitt Romney. Thank you. God bless you. And may he continue to bless the United States of America.
And that was Nikki Haley. She's the governor of South Carolina. We are going now to Governor Mary Fallon, who is the governor of Oklahoma. Hello there.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. You come from quite a conservative state. Does Mitt Romney appeal to conservatives and Tea Party voters, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the state of Oklahoma is such a conservative state that it's the only state in the nation where President Obama lost every single county in the state. And, of course, Mitt Romney right now has about a 35% lead.
We're hearing from so many women speakers this evening, and yet many of the polls show a big gender gap, though. How can Romney broaden his appeal to female voters?
I think he'll broaden his appeal tonight, especially after Ann Romney speaks, and when people learn more about Mitt Romney. I mean, if you look at what are the real concerns of women, and I and my husband have six kids together, you know, we're concerned about our children's future. We're concerned about the debt, the deficit. We're concerned about our children being able to find a job when they either get out of high school or go on to college. We're concerned about what their future is going to hold. And I think once Mitt Romney and Ann Romney have the opportunity to talk to women more directly, and they will tonight and certainly for the rest of this convention, women will come to see that Mitt Romney offers a better solution, a better chance to move Oklahoma and, frankly, to move our whole nation forward.
All right, Governor Mary Fallon of Oklahoma, thank you so much.
Good talking to you.
And we're joined now by Jeff Brady, NPR's Jeff Brady, who is on the floor there in Tampa. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I'm in the Colorado delegation, and I'm standing with Colorado's Attorney General John Suthers. And you've been involved in Mitt Romney's campaign all the way dating back to 2008, right?
I met Mitt Romney in April of 2007 at a dinner in Denver, jumped on board, and I've been a supporter ever since.
All right. And now, if he were elected president, he would be the first president who is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You say that for people in Western states like Colorado, that's just not a big deal.
It really isn't. About 4 or 5% of the population in Colorado is Mormon. We all, you know, work with Mormons. We all socialize with Mormons. We're part of political parties with Mormons. We all have a great deal of admiration for the family values they bring, the hard work ethic they bring, and it's just not a factor in the West. I can't speak for other parts of the country, but because of the way we all work with Mormons and deal with them every day and admire what they stand for, I just don't think religion's going to be any kind of a factor in a swing state like Colorado.
And I remember you telling me this in 2008 when he was running in the primary campaign. Have you seen an evolution in how Mormons are perceived even outside of the West since then, do you think?
I really can't speak for outside the West, but I know that, as you know, he won the preference poll in 2008. Santorum won it this last time, but it was relatively close. And I can assure you that religion isn't a factor in the race in Colorado.
Colorado, one of those states that's been swinging lately. The electorate has split about a third between Republicans, Democrats, and unaffiliated. You might even say militantly unaffiliated, some of them. How are things looking in Colorado now?
I feel pretty good about it. You see a poll that has Obama up by one or two. You see one that's got Romney up by one or two. Those are usually all registered voter polls. The fact of the matter is I think we've got more momentum. We're going to turn out voters in greater numbers, and I feel very confident.
I see that Ann Romney has taken the stage there, and you said you want to hear everything she has to say.
I am looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, NPR's Jeff Brady, thank you so much. And now Ann Romney, the wife of presidential candidate Mitt Romney, is at the podium in Tampa, Florida, getting a rousing applause there. She's wearing bright red. She was asking reporters on the plane today what they thought she should wear tonight. So this was apparently a last-minute decision. She's gone with a bright red outfit. She's being warmly received at the Tampa Bay Times Foreign. Ann Romney.
Thank you, and thank you, Luce. I can't wait to see what we're going to all do together. This is going to be so exciting. Just so you all know, the hurricane has hit landfall, and I think we should all take this moment and recognize that fellow Americans are in its path and just hope and pray that all remain safe and no life is lost and no property is lost. So we should all be thankful for this great country and grateful for our first responders and all that keep us safe in this wonderful country. Well, I want to talk to you tonight not about politics and not about party. And while there are many important issues we'll hear discussed in this convention and throughout this campaign, tonight I want to talk to you from my heart about our hearts. I want to talk not about what divides us, but what holds us together as an American family. I want to talk to you tonight about that one great thing that unites us, that one great thing that brings us our greatest joy when times are good, and the deepest solace in our dark hours. Tonight, I want to talk to you about love. I want to talk to you about the deep and abiding love I have for a man I met at a dance many years ago, and the profound love I have, and I know we share, for this country. I want to talk to you about that love so deep, only a mother can fathom it, the love we have for our children and our children's children. And I want us to think tonight about the love we share for those Americans, our brothers and our sisters, who are going through difficult times, whose days are never easy, nights are always long, and whose work never seems done. They are here among us tonight in this hall. They are here in neighborhoods across Tampa and all across America. The parents who lie awake at night side by side, wondering how they'll be able to pay the mortgage or make the rent. The single dad who's working extra hours tonight so that his kids can buy some new clothes to go back to school, can take a school trip or play a sport, so his kids can feel, you know, just like other kids. And the working moms who love their jobs but would like to work just a little less to spend more time with the kids. But that's just out of the question with this economy. Or how about that couple who would like to have another child but wonder how they'll afford it? I have been all across this country, and I know a lot of you guys. And I have seen and heard stories of how hard it is to get ahead now. You know what? I've heard your voices. They've said to me, I'm running in place and we just can't get ahead. Sometimes I think that late at night, if we were all silent for just a few moments and listened carefully, we could hear a collective sigh from the moms and dads across America who made it through another day and know that they'll make it through another one tomorrow. But in the end of that day moment, they just aren't sure how. And if you listen carefully, you'll hear the women sighing a little bit more than the men. It's how it is, isn't it? It's the moms who have always had to work a little harder to make everything right. It's the moms of this nation, single, married, widowed, who really hold this country together. We're the mothers. We're the wives. We're the grandmothers, we're the big sisters, we're the little sisters, and we are the daughters. You know it's true, don't you? I love you, women! And I hear your voices. Those are my favorite fans down there. You are the ones that have to do a little bit more, and you know what it's like to work a little harder during the day to earn the respect you deserve at work. And then you come home at night and help with a book report, just because it has to be done. You know what those late-night phone calls with an elderly parent are like, and the long weekend drives just to see how they're doing. You know the fastest route to the local emergency room, and which doctors actually answer the phone call when you call at night. By the way, I know all about that. You know what it's like to sit in that graduation ceremony and wonder how it was that so many long days turned to years that went by so quickly. You are the best of America. You. You are the hope of America. There would not be an America without you. Tonight, we salute you and sing your praises. not sure if men really understand this, but I don't think there's a woman in America who really expects her life to be easy. In our own ways, we all know better. You know what? And that's fine. We don't want easy. But the last few years have been harder than they needed to be. It's all the little things that the price at the pump you just can't believe, the grocery bills that just get bigger, all those things that used to be free, like school sports, are now one more bill to pay. It's all the little things that pile up to become big things, and the big things, the good jobs, the chance at college, that home you want to buy, just get harder. Everything has become harder. We're too smart to know there aren't easy answers, but we're not dumb enough to accept that there aren't better answers. Is where this boy I met at a high school dance comes in. His name is Mitt Romney, and you should really get to know him. I could tell you why I fell in love with him. He was tall, laughed a lot. He was nervous. Girls like that. It shows a guy's a little intimidated. He was nice to my parents, but he was also really glad when they weren't around. I don't mind that, but more than anything, he made me laugh. Some of you might not know this, but I am the granddaughter of a Welsh coal miner. He was determined that his kids get out of the mines. My dad got his first job when he was 6 years old in a little village in Wales called Nanty Hufflin, cleaning bottles at the Collier's Arms. When he was 15, Dad came to America. In our country, he saw hope and an opportunity to escape from poverty. He moved to a small town in the great state of Michigan. Michigan! Yes. There he started the business, one he built by himself, by the way. He raised a family and he became mayor of our town. My dad would often remind my brothers and me how fortunate we were to grow up in a place like America. He wanted us to have every opportunity that came with life in this country, and so he pushed us to be our best and give our all. Inside the houses that lined the streets of our town, there were a lot of good fathers teaching their sons and daughters those same values. I didn't know it at the time, but one of those dads was my future father-in-law, George Romney. Mitt's dad never graduated from college. Instead, he became a carpenter. He worked hard, he became the head of a car company, and then the governor of Michigan. When Mitt and I met and fell in love, we were determined not to let anything stand in the way of our life together. I was an Episcopalian, he was a Mormon. We were very young, both still in college. There were many reasons to delay marriage, and you know what? We just didn't care. We got married and moved into a basement apartment. We walked to class together, shared the housekeeping, ate a lot of pasta and tuna fish. Our desk was a door propped up on sawhorses. Our dining room table was a fold-down ironing board in the kitchen. But those were the best days. Then our first son came along. All at once, I'm 22 years old with a baby and a husband who's going to business school and law school at the same time. And I can tell you, probably like every other girl who finds herself in a new life far from family and friends, with a new baby and a new husband, that it dawned on me that I had absolutely no idea what I was getting into. Well, that was 42 years ago. I've survived. We now have 5 sons and 18 beautiful grandchildren.
We're listening to Ann Romney. This is live coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention.
I'm still in love with that boy I met at a high school dance, and he still makes me laugh. I read somewhere that Mitt and I have a storybook marriage. Well, let me tell you something. In the storybooks I read, There never were long, long rainy winter afternoons in a house with five boys screaming at once. And those storybooks never seem to have chapters called MS or breast cancer. A storybook marriage? Nope, not at all. What Mitt Romney and I have is a real marriage. Good and decent man for what he is. He's warm and loving and patient. He has tried to live his life with a set of values centered on family, faith, and love of one's fellow man. From the time we were first married, I've seen him spend countless hours helping others. I've seen him drop everything to help a friend in trouble and been there when late-night calls of panic come from a member of our church whose child has been taken to the hospital. You may not agree with Mitt's positions on issues or his politics. By the way, Massachusetts is only 13% Republican, so it's not like it's a shock to me. But, let me say this to every American who is thinking about who should be our next president. No one will work harder. No one will care more. And no one will move heaven and earth like Mitt Romney to make this country a better place to live. It's true that Mitt's been successful at each new challenge he's taken on. You know what? It actually amazes me to see his history of success being attacked. Are those really the values that made our country great?
No.
As a mom of five boys, do we want to raise our children to be afraid of success?
No.
Do we send our children out in the world with the advice, try to do okay? And let's be honest, if the last 4 years had been more successful, do we really think there would be this attack on Mitt Romney's success?
No!
Of course not. Mitt will be the first to tell you that he is the most fortunate man in the world. He had two loving parents who gave him strong values and taught him the value of work. He had the chance to get the education his father never had. But as his partner on this amazing journey, I can tell you, Mitt Romney was not handed success. He built it. Massachusetts after graduate school and got a job. I saw the long hours that started with that first job. I was there when he had a small group of friends talking about starting a new company. I was there when they struggled and wondered if the whole idea just wasn't going to work. Mitt's reaction was to work harder and press on. Today, that company has become another great American success story. Has it made those who started the company successful? Made them successful beyond their dreams? Yes, it has. It allowed us to give our sons the chance at good educations and made all those long hours of book reports and homework worth every minute. It's given us the deep satisfaction of being able to help others in ways that we could never have imagined. This is important. I want you to hear what I'm going to say. Mitt doesn't like to talk about how he has helped others because he sees it as a privilege. Not a political talking point. We are no different than the millions of Americans who quietly help their neighbors, their churches, and their communities. They don't do it so that others will think more of them. They do it because there is no greater joy. Give, and it shall be given unto you. But because this is America, that small company which grew has helped so many others lead better lives. The jobs that grew from the risks they took have become college educations and first homes. That success has helped fund scholarships, pensions, and retirement funds. This is the genius of America. Dreams fulfilled help others launch new dreams. At every turn in his life, this man I met at a high school dance has helped lift up others. He did it with the Olympics when many wanted to give up. He did it in Massachusetts, where he guided the state from economic crisis to unemployment of just 4.7%. Under Mitt, Massachusetts' schools were the best in the nation. The best. He started something that I really love. He started the John and Abigail Adams Scholarship, which give the top 25% of high school graduates a four-year tuition-free scholarship. This is the man America needs. This is the man who will wake up every day with a determination to solve the problems that others say can't be solved, to fix what others say is beyond repair. This is the man who will work harder than anyone so that we can work a little less hard. I can't tell you what will happen over the next 4 years, but I can only stand here tonight as a wife and a mother and a grandmother, an American, and make you this solemn commitment. This man will not fail. Let us down. This man will lift up America. It has been 47 years since that tall, kind of charming young man brought me home from our first dance. Not every day since has been easy, but he still makes me laugh, and never once did I have a single reason to doubt that I was the luckiest woman in the world tonight. I said tonight I wanted to talk to you about love. Look into your hearts. This is our country. This is our future. These are our children and grandchildren. You can trust Mitt. He loves America. He will take us to a better place, just as he took me home safely from that dance. Give him that chance. Give America that chance. God bless each and every one of you, and God bless the United States of America.
And that was Ann Romney, the wife of presidential candidate Mitt Romney, warmly received on there, a rousing speech at I think that's a stunning success. And now Mitt Romney is making a surprise appearance, coming out onto the stage as well. He had not been scheduled to come down until Thursday. He flew down today. He's just given her a kiss and a quick hug. He is making a surprise appearance here. The two of them, Mitt and Ann Romney, standing on the stage at the Tampa convention. Brian, NPR's Brian Naylor is on the floor there. Brian, how'd that go over?
Well, it went over very well. There's lots of
NPR's Brian Naylor is on the floor there. Brian, how'd that go over?
Well, it went over very well. There's lots of applause, people standing, holding up banners. I'm in the Florida delegation with Congresswoman Sandy Adams. What's your take on that speech? It was said that she needed to humanize Mitt Romney tonight. Do you think that that occurred?
I think he is human, and I think it's very special, and I think that she has been an awesome spokesperson for the campaign and also for women across America.
Does she help him win votes for amongst those independents that haven't yet made up their minds?
I think if people listen, I think she helps.
And the gender gap, we've all heard so much about. There's such women tend to support Democrats much more often than Republicans. Is that can Mitt Romney change that?
I believe so. You know, I've been in Congress now a little less than 2 years. I've heard this whole fake war thing going on. And that's exactly what it is. It's fake war. The Republicans have always stood for and helped support women. You know, as someone who was once a single parent who made it from a high school dropout to a congressperson, and I'm Republican. So I believe that Republicans are very much behind women. And under this administration, under the Obama administration, more women have lost jobs.
Did you learn anything new about Mitt Romney tonight from Mrs. Romney that you hadn't known before?
I think that it's very special to listen to her recount her story and also to share their story with America.
Congresswoman Sandy Adams, thanks very much for taking the time.
Jennifer, back to you.
All right, Brian Naylor, thank you so much. Ron Elving, that was, correct me if I'm wrong, quite a successful speech there by Ann Romney.
This is, after all, not a professional speaker. She is not someone who's run for office. She's not somebody who addresses huge crowds for a living, as many of the other people we've heard from today are. And she did a wonderful job, I would say, of not only communicating her own feelings towards her husband, but also building out from that the political case for why he deserves another look by those people who may have found him rather off-putting or chilly in their encounters with him up to now in the media.
Matt Continetti, she was good.
She was good. I mean, she sounds like a candidate. She has a kind of a strident tone to her, kind of a straight talk. That I think is going to be a different model for First Lady, should she become that, than we've seen with Michelle Obama or even with Laura Bush. I think she's more like Barbara Bush than those two.
Okay, we are waiting now for the keynote speaker tonight. Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey is now coming out on the stage in Tampa.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Well, this stage and this moment are very improbable for me, a New Jersey Republican, delivering the keynote address to our national convention. From a state with 700,000 more Democrats than Republicans, a New Jersey Republican stands before you tonight. Proud of my party, proud of my state, and proud of my country. Now I am the son of an Irish father and a Sicilian mother. My dad, who I'm blessed to have here with me tonight, is gregarious, outgoing, and lovable. My mom, who I lost 8 years ago, was the enforcer. Now, she made sure we all knew who set the rules. Tell it to you this way. In the automobile of life, dad was just a passenger. Mom was the driver. Now, they both lived hard lives. Dad grew up in poverty, and after returning from Army service, he worked at the Breyers ice cream plant in the 1950s. Now, with that job and the GI Bill, he put himself through Rutgers University at night to become the first and his family to earn a college degree. And our first family picture was on his graduation day with my mom beaming next to him, 6 months pregnant with me. Now, mom also came from nothing. She was raised by a single mother who took three different buses every day to get to work. And mom spent the time that she was supposed to be a kid actually raising children, her younger brother and younger sister. She was tough as nails and didn't suffer fools at all, and the truth was, she couldn't afford to. She spoke the truth, bluntly, directly, and without much varnish. I am her son. I was her son as I listened to Darkness on the Edge of Town with my high school friends on the Jersey Shore. I was her son when I moved into that studio apartment with Mary Pat to start a marriage that's now 26 years old. I was her son as I coached our sons, Andrew and Patrick, on the fields of Mendham, and as I watched with pride as our daughters, Sarah and Bridget, marched with their soccer teams in the Labor Day parade. And I'm still her son today as governor, following the rules she taught me, to speak from the heart and to fight for your principles. You see, mom never thought you'd get extra credit just for speaking the truth. And the greatest lesson that mom ever taught me, though, was this one. She told me there would be times in your life when you have to choose between being loved and being respected. Now, she said to always pick being respected. She told me that love without respect was always fleeting, but that respect could grow into real and lasting love. Now, of course, she was talking about women. But I've learned over time that it applies just as much to leadership. In fact, I think that advice applies to America more than ever today. You see, I believe we have become paralyzed by our desire to be loved. Now, our founding fathers had the wisdom to know that social acceptance and popularity were fleeting, and that this country's principles needed to be rooted in strains greater than the passions and the emotions of the times. But our leaders today have decided it's more important to be popular, to say and do what's easy, and say yes rather than to say no, when no is what is required. And in recent years, we as a country have too often chosen the same path. It's been easy for our leaders to say, not us, not now, in taking on the really tough issues. And unfortunately, we've stood silently by and let them get away with it. But tonight, I say enough. Tonight, I say together, let's make a much different choice. Tonight, we are speaking up for ourselves and stepping up. Tonight, we're beginning to do what is right and what is necessary to make America great again. We are demanding that our leaders stop tearing each other down and work together to take action on the big things facing America. Tonight, we are going to do what my mother taught me. Tonight, we're going to choose respect over love. See, we're not afraid. We are not afraid. We're taking our country back because we are the great-grandchildren of the men and women who broke their backs in the name of American ingenuity, the grandchildren of the greatest generation, the sons and daughters of immigrants, the brothers and sisters of everyday heroes, the neighbors of entrepreneurs and firefighters, teachers and farmers, veterans and factory workers, and everyone in between who shows up not just on the big days or the good days, but on the bad days and the hard days, each and every day. All 365 of them, You see, we are the United States of America.
We're listening to Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey. This is live coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention.
Now, it's up to us. We must lead the way our citizens live. To lead as my mother insisted I live. Not by avoiding truths, especially the hard ones, but by facing up to them and being better for it. We can't afford to do anything less. Now, I know this because this was the challenge in New Jersey. When I came into office, I could continue on the same path that led to wealth and jobs and people leaving our state. Or I could do the job people elected me to do the big things. Now, there were those who said it couldn't be done, that the problems were too big, too politically charged, and too broken to fix. But we were on a path we could no longer afford to follow. Now, they said it was impossible, this is what they told me, to cut taxes in a state where taxes were raised 115 times in the 8 years before I became governor. That it was impossible to balance a budget at the same time with an $11 billion deficit. But 3 years later, we have three balanced budgets in a row with lower taxes. We did it. They said it was impossible to touch the third rail of politics, to take on the public sector unions, and to reform a pension and health benefit system that was headed to bankruptcy. But with bipartisan leadership, we saved taxpayers $132 billion over 30 years and saved retirees their pensions. We did it. They said it was impossible to speak the truth to the teachers' union. They were just too powerful. A real teacher tenure reform that demands accountability and ends the guarantee of a job for life regardless of performance. They said it would never happen. But for the first time in 100 years, with bipartisan support, you know the answer, we did it. Now, the disciples of yesterday's politics, they always underestimate the will of the people. They assumed our people were selfish, that when told of the difficult problems, the tough choices, and the complicated solutions, that they would simply turn their backs, that they would decide it was every man for himself. They were wrong. The people of New Jersey stepped up. They shared in the sacrifice. And you know what else they did? They rewarded politicians who led instead of politicians who pandered. But you know, we shouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't be surprised. We've never been a country to shy away from the truth. Our history shows that we stand up when it counts. And it's this quality that has defined America's character and our significance in the world. Now, I know this simple truth, and I am not afraid to say it. Our ideas are right for America, and their ideas have failed America. Let me be clear with the American people tonight. Here's what we believe as Republicans, and what they believe as Democrats. We believe in telling hardworking families the truth about our country's fiscal realities, telling them what they already know. The math of federal spending does not add up. With $5 trillion in debt added over the last 4 years, we have no other option but to make the hard choices, cut federal spending, and fundamentally reduce the size of this government. Want to know what they believe? They believe that the American people don't want to hear the truth about the extent of our fiscal difficulties. They believe the American people need to be coddled by big government. They believe the American people are content to live the lie with them. They're wrong. We believe in telling our seniors the truth about our overburdened entitlements. We know seniors not only want these programs to survive, but they just as badly want them secured for their grandchildren. Our seniors are not selfish. Here's what they believe. They believe seniors will always put themselves ahead of their grandchildren. And here's what they do. They prey on their vulnerabilities and scare them with misinformation for the single, cynical purpose of winning the next election. Here's their plan. Whistle a happy tune while driving us off the fiscal cliff, as long as they are behind the wheel of power when we fall. Now, we believe that the majority of teachers in America know our system must be reformed to put students first so that America can compete. Now, teachers don't teach to become rich or famous. They teach because they love children. We believe that we should honor and reward the good ones while doing what's best for our nation's future, demanding accountability, demanding higher standards, and demanding the best teacher in every classroom in America. Get ready. Get ready. Here's what they believe. They believe the educational establishment will always put themselves ahead of children, that self-interest will always trump common sense. They believe in pitting unions against teachers, educators against parents, lobbyists against children. They believe in teachers' unions. We believe in teachers. We believe that if we tell the people the truth, that they will act bigger than the pettiness we see in Washington, D.C. We believe it's possible to forge bipartisan compromise and stand up for our conservative principles. You see, because it's always been the power of our ideas, not our rhetoric, that attracts people to our party. We win when we make it about what needs to be done. We lose when we play along with their game of scaring and dividing. For make no mistake about it, everybody, the problems are too big to let the American people lose. The slowest economic recovery in decades, a spiraling out of control deficit, and an education system that's failing to compete in the world. It doesn't matter how we got here. There's enough blame to go around. What matters is what we do now. See, I know we can fix our problems. When there are people in the room who care more about doing the job they were elected to do than they worry about winning re-election, it's possible to work together, achieve principled compromise, and get results for the people who gave us these jobs in the first place. The people have no patience for any other way anymore. It's simple. We need politicians to care more about doing something and less about being something. And believe me, if we could do this in a blue state like New Jersey with a conservative Republican governor, Washington, D.C. is out of excuses. Leadership delivers. Leadership counts. Leadership matters. And here's the great news I came here tonight to bring you. We have this leader for America. We have a nominee who will tell us the truth and who will lead with conviction, and now he has a running mate who will do the same. We have Governor Mitt Romney and Congressman Paul Ryan, and we need to make him the next president and vice president of the United States. You see, because I know Mitt Romney. I know Mitt Romney, and Mitt Romney will tell us the hard truths we need to hear to put us back on a path to growth and create good-paying private sector jobs again in America. Mitt Romney will tell us the hard truths we need to hear to end the torrent of debt that is compromising our future and burying our economy. Mitt Romney will tell us the hard truths we need to hear to end the debacle of putting the world's greatest health care system in the hands of federal bureaucrats and putting those bureaucrats between an American citizen and her doctor. Now, we ended an era of absentee leadership without purpose or principle in New Jersey. I'm here to tell you tonight, it is time to end this era of absentee leadership in the Oval Office and send real leaders back to the White House. America needs Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, and we need them right now. Now, but we got to tell each other the truth, right? Listen, there is doubt and fear for our future in every corner of our country. I have traveled all the country, and I've seen this myself. These feelings are real. This moment is real. And it's a moment like this where some skeptics wonder if American greatness is over. They wonder how those who have come before us had the spirit and the tenacity to lead America to a new era of greatness in the face of challenge. Not to look around and say, not me. But to look around and say, yes, me. Now, I have an answer tonight for the skeptics and the naysayers, the dividers and the defenders of the status quo. I have faith in us. I know we can be the men and women our country calls on us to be tonight. I believe in America and our history, and there's only one thing missing now, leadership. It takes leadership that you don't get from reading a poll. You see, Mr. President, real leaders don't follow polls. Real leaders change polls. And that's what we need. That's what we need to do now. We need to change polls through the power of our principles. We need to change polls through the strength of our convictions. Tonight, our duty is to tell the American people the truth. Our problems are big and the solutions will not be painless. We all must share in the sacrifice, and any leader that tells us differently is simply not telling the truth. Now, I think tonight of the greatest generation. We look back and marvel at their courage, overcoming the Great Depression, fighting Nazi tyranny, standing up for freedom around the world. Well, now it's our time to answer history's call. For make no mistake, every generation will be judged, and so will we. And what will our children and grandchildren say of us? Will they say we buried our heads in the sand, we assuaged ourselves with the creature comforts we've acquired, that our problems were too big and we were too small, that someone else should make a difference? Because we can't. Or will they say of us that we stood up and made the tough choices that needed to be made to preserve our way of life? You see, I don't know about you, but I don't want my children and grandchildren to have to read in a history book what it was like to live in an American century. I don't want their only inheritance to be an enormous government that has overtaxed, overspent, and overborrowed a great people into second-class citizenship. I want them to live in a second American century. A second American century. a second American century of strong economic growth where those who are willing to work hard will have good-paying jobs to support their families and reach their dreams. A second American century where real American exceptionalism is not a political punchline, but is evident to everyone in the world just by watching the way our government conducts its business every day and the way Americans live their lives. A second American century where our military is strong, our values are sure, our work ethic is unmatched, and our Constitution remains a model for anyone in the world struggling for liberty. Let us choose a path that will be remembered for generations to come. Standing strong for freedom will make the next century as great an American century as the last one. You see, this is the American way. We have never been victims of destiny. We have always been the masters of our own. And I know you agree with me on this. I will not be part of the generation that fails that test, and neither will you. All right. It's now time to stand up. Let's stand up. Everybody stand up. Stand up, because there's no time left to waste. If you're willing to stand up with me for America's future, I will stand up with you. If you're willing to fight with me for Mitt Romney, I will fight with you. If you're willing to hear the truth, to hear the truth about the hard road ahead and the rewards for America that truth will bear, I'm here to begin with you this new era of truth-telling. Tonight, we choose the path that has always defined our nation's history. Tonight, we finally and firmly answer the call that so many generations have had the courage to answer before us. Tonight, we stand up for Mitt Romney as the next president of the United States, and together, everybody, together, we will stand up once again for American greatness for our children and grandchildren. God bless you and God bless America.
And that was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, the keynote speaker at tonight's Republican National Convention. This is NPR News, and you're listening to live special coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention from Tampa. There is a rousing applause there for Governor Chris Christie. Mitt Romney and his wife Ann, who spoke earlier, are in the audience there standing up as Governor Chris Christie rounds out the evening of speakers. And Jeff Brady, NPR's Jeff Brady, is now on the floor in Tampa with a delegate. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. I'm hanging out with the folks from New Jersey. I'm with Bud Wilson. He's from Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And I heard you several times sort of pumping your fist and saying, yes, yes. What do you like about Chris Christie?
Well, I think a lot of people, we can learn from Chris Christie. He can relate to the common man. He, how he talks, he relates to us and relates to us in our everyday lives. He doesn't just tell facts, he tells stories, and we can engage with that. That's what I love about him. And he's made it bold decisions for New Jersey, like taking on the teachers' unions, and he's been very successful.
Well, and there was a point where he said, they believe in teachers' unions, and we believe in teachers.
We do, absolutely. My wife is a former teacher, and she loves her children. We all love our children. But we do think teachers need to be more accountable to our children.
Getting back to this idea of he is able to tell stories, what do you mean by that? Who are some of the other people who are able to tell stories who are in the political world?
I think Ronald Reagan was wonderful. I think he was the great communicator. I think Bill Clinton can relate to the common man as well. And that comes back to their upbringings. Ronald Reagan from Eureka, Illinois. Bill Clinton from Hope, Arkansas. You know, there's a lot of street smarts, a lot of common sense, and I think Chris Christie brings that to people.
So Mitt Romney is the nominee here. Do you see Chris Christie being a nominee down the road?
Lord, I don't know. I really don't know. I think he has a wonderful chance. He has a strong following across America. He does. A strong following. And we'd love to see him at the Reagan Library sometime. Yeah.
All right, that is Bud Wilson, a delegate from Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Back to you.
Okay, thanks, NPR's Jeff Brady. And we've now been joined by NPR White House correspondent Ari Shapiro, who's now squeezing into our little booth down there in Tampa. Hi, Ari.
Hi, Jennifer.
So we had a surprise appearance from Mitt Romney. Let me just say there's a band on stage there. That's the noise you're hearing in the background as we continue to bring you live coverage here. Tell us how it came about that Mitt Romney appeared this evening.
Well, Mitt Romney and Ann Romney both started their day in Boston, and we all flew down with them on a plane together, knowing that Mitt was going to be here, but not knowing for sure that he was going to be out on stage with his wife, Ann. Mitt's scheduled to fly to Indiana tomorrow for an event that was previously scheduled, and of course his big speech is on Thursday. But on the flight down, Ann talked a little bit with reporters about how she was preparing for this speech. She does a lot of campaigning with her husband, but she always speaks off the cuff. She never uses prepared remarks, and she said she was practicing giving a speech off the printed text and reading off a teleprompter. She frankly said, "I don't like it. It's hard." This was her first time doing it tonight, and I'll tell you, as she finished her comments, one reporter sitting near me turned to me and said, "We just witnessed the birth of a political superstar," which may not be a consensus view, but I think there's no question that for her first time giving a speech off a teleprompter, off a prepared text, maybe she was trying to set low expectations on the flight down, but she did pretty well.
She did pretty well. She brought a lot to that. All right, Ari, thanks so much. And I think you're also joined there by NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving and E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post. I've got Matt Continetti here of The Washington Free Beacon. Is Mara Liasson with us also?
I'm right here.
Hey, NPR's national political correspondent. That was quite a surprise and a good speech by Ann Romney.
Yes, I think we could all agree with that. Mara, I'd like to hear you address that first.
Yeah, I think it was a good speech by Ann Romney. She related her own personal story with Mitt to what she thinks he can do for America. That was her job. She was supposed to humanize him. I mean, that's a word that's been used a lot. But he's somebody who's very reluctant to do that for himself. And she told the story of their love affair. She talked about how he doesn't like to talk about the good things he does for people because he thinks that that's not something that you do to get political credit. He says it's not a political talking point. And she also made the point, she says, we're not any different than millions of Americans who quietly help their neighborhoods, churches, or communities. And that is something that the Romney campaign really wants to get across, that Mitt Romney is not a wealthy, out-of-touch plutocrat. She also delivered, I think, what was kind of the bottom line message, which is that more than anything else, Mitt Romney's story is the story of success. She said, I can't tell you what will happen, but I can only tell you this. I can make you this commitment. This man will not fail. So she gave a strong, good, hard sell for her husband.
E.J. Dionne, and she went out of her way to relate to people who are less well-off, repeatedly mentioning people who are struggling in this economy, mentioning working moms who'd like to work less but can't afford to.
You know, I hate to dissent on this because the reason is I had particularly high expectations of Ann Romney. I saw her when Mitt Romney announced his candidacy in New Hampshire way back in 2001. It seems like 100 years ago. And she came on, and I thought she was extraordinarily effective when she was spontaneous. She spoke about him in a very personal way, talked about how he had taken care of her when she was sick. I was totally impressed by her. Tonight, this speech seemed to be a speech that was carrying too much of the weight of what political consultants wanted to do with the convention. You know, if the last 4 years had been more successful, do we really think there would be this attack on Mitt Romney's success? Not a bad line, but it freighted the speech with politics. We're too smart to know where there aren't easy answers, but we're not dumb enough to know to accept that there aren't better answers. Again, good line, but I thought it was a little too freighted with politics. I just want to say, Chris Christie's speech really sets a standard for Mitt Romney tomorrow night. I fundamentally disagree with Chris Christie and where he would have us go as a country, but it was a very effective speech in talking about American greatness, in challenging Americans. I think it sets a really high bar for Romney. I would lastly note, He talked about the job and the GI Bill that his grandfather or father had. That sounds like government helping somebody make it to me.
You know, what's getting some attention in the blogosphere and in the Twitter world is the number of words in the Rick Santorum speech before he mentioned the name Mitt Romney.
Yes.
There were well over 1,100 such words, and I think only a handful after Mitt Romney's name came up. So that's getting noticed. Rick Santorum was given a featured spot in this speech tonight and doesn't seem to have paid it back too well. Also being noted that Chris Christie went quite a long time before he mentioned Mitt Romney. Maybe the two phenomena were somewhat related. Maybe both of them were a little more interested in how they were going to come across than in how much they could do for Mitt Romney. But in the end, I think Chris Christie gave that sort of broad-based general attack that you expect from a keynoter. Keynote speeches are not supposed to be an introduction to the candidate speech. They're supposed to be, as E.J. was saying, a base on which then the candidate can come out and speak. They're not supposed to be about the candidate.
All right. And NPR's Ron Elving, thank you. Matt Continenti, what did you take away from Chris Christie's speech?
Well, I think Christie gave a speech on the level of generality that will make it very effective to the independent voters, to the mainstream of the country. I think he's right kind of in that Scott Brown spot of American politics where it's very hard to, you know, to dislike you. I want to pick up on something E.J. mentioned about Ann Romney's speech that I thought was interesting. There was kind of a tension in Ann Romney's speech between those moments of real empathy and sympathy where she was talking about all the struggling families, and she understands how when people were going to bed at night, they let out that collective sigh. And then on the other hand, there was this very, as I said, almost strident defense of success and her husband's success, and how dare you question our success. I think those two poles of the speech actually were in conflict with one another. And even though I thought it was a successful speech overall, the more I think about it, that tension, I think, could end up possibly even hurting the ticket in some ways. But overall, I thought Christie's speech was, you know, it's funny to see Christie gesticulating like that and calling for leadership, and these types of emotions, these visceral reactions Chris Christie summons are not those that one would associate with, say, Mitt Romney, who seems almost overwhelmed looking at the expression on his face as he sits there in the convention. He seems almost overwhelmed by the proceedings.
We should also mention that, of course, Chris Christie didn't make mention of this, but New Jersey remains in a tough fiscal situation. It just had its unemployment tick up a bit last month, so it's not all rosy there. A lot of commentators have been pointing that out. E.J. Dionne, does this raise the bar a lot, though, for Mitt Romney, who he's capping this event, but he's got some really strong speakers here on the lineup ahead of him.
Right. I do think it sets a high standard for Mitt Romney in a couple of respects. One is, just rhetorically, I thought Christie was very good and very powerful in the way he delivered, and it was, I think, addressed to swing voters. He also had a really interesting line, which we could parse in a philosophy class. I believe we have become paralyzed by our desire to be loved. I never expected to hear that at a political convention. But the other thing is, Chris Christie talked about shared sacrifice. That's Obama's message. That's not Romney's message. Obama is saying rich people have to give in order for us to do better in the long haul. A shared sacrifice isn't what Romney is talking about. It'll be interesting to see if he picks up on that and takes it there or just leaves that to tonight.
It'll be interesting to see what he wants someone to sacrifice. What is he talking about? What is his alternative version of shared sacrifice?
Right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Jennifer, I don't think we should expect to see a whole lot that is new from Romney on Thursday. His aides on the plane down today said this will be very much a continuation, a direct through line from the speech that he delivered when he announced his presidential bid in New Hampshire, that it is not starting a new chapter. It is not introducing him to new people in a new way. It is just the same message, perhaps delivered in a slightly different venue.
All right, yes, they're chilling the expectations just a little bit.
We're going to jump down to the floor there again. Brian Naylor has some more reaction for us. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you. I'm down in the on the floor of the rapidly emptying Tampa Bay Times Forum as the convention has been formally gaveled to a close. But a delegate from Alabama, William Smith, is kind enough to stick around for a moment and wearing a very proper Alabama seersucker suit. What was the high point of the convention for you tonight?
Well, I think there were two of them. One was Ann Romney's speech, and I think her most telling line was, talking about all of the things that her and her husband had been through, and that you could trust Mitt, and that America could trust Mitt Romney.
That was a point that a lot of folks coming into tonight said that she needed to make. She needed to help humanize him to some extent. Do you think she succeeded?
I think she did. I think she very much did. Nobody knows him better than she does, and she did a great job of conveying him and who he is and the qualities about him to America.
Do you think that's going to help with voters who are still on the fence? There are still a few voters out there who are undecided. Is what she said tonight help maybe convince them that he is somebody that they can trust, as she said?
Yes, I do. I think that just her whole talk and her whole story about how they met and how they dated and all the way to the end when they're, you know, getting married and all the struggles they have been through and all the successes, yes.
And I'm just curious, as a guy from Alabama, what'd you think of that guy from New Jersey, Chris Christie?
I liked him. I'm also a Bruce Springsteen fan. I know that the governor is a big Springsteen fan, but I thought he gave a great speech. I'm with him. I want future generations to read about a second American century.
And I'm just wondering, do you think he made the same point that trying to reach out to voters who haven't decided yet? This seemed to me, it seemed a little bit more of a kind of a red meat speech that got a lot of the Republican folks here excited. I wonder how you think it might have played back those watching at home.
Well, you know, he's in a Democratic state elected him governor because of his straight talk. And I think that his straight talk, particularly that one of the lines that sticks in my mind, is the one he said that real leaders don't follow polls, they change them. I think that's what he has done. And I think that we're at a point in history where we need true leadership to step up and take charge and change polls and lead us in the right direction.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
It's William Smith, a delegate from the state of Alabama. Jennifer, back to you.
Thanks, Brian Naylor. Mara Eliason, these conventions are often seen as sort of a tryout for future party leaders. And Chris Christie there was a lobbying effort to get him to run for president earlier in this campaign. What do you think tonight's speech did for his prospects?
Well, these keynote addresses are often launching pads for people. Barack Obama had one. Bill Clinton had one. And I think that Chris Christie is considered a future candidate for president. He's already a rock star in his party. He has a big following. And I think he did himself some good. He put himself on the map. Not everybody knew about who he was. He has a kind of unvarnished personality that's really appealing. He's a big favorite with the Tea Party. He's very raw and pugnacious and confrontational, and he's almost the opposite of Mitt Romney. There's nothing really super polished about him. And I think that he helped himself. I mean, one of the interesting storylines at any convention is the jockeying for the next time. And one thing about the Republican Party is they have a very strong bench. Christie, Ryan, Rubio, we're going to hear from a lot of those, the contenders for 2016 or 2020 this week. And Mitt Romney is seen by many people here as a transitional figure. You know, he never really got in sync with the Tea Party. He's a kind of mainstream, formerly moderate Republican, a kind of vanishing breed, kind of tried to retool himself for the new Tea Party era. But he doesn't excite a whole lot in the party. But people like Christie, people like Ryan and Rubio, who are all probably going to run next time, really do. And this is their debut on the national stage. And I think Christie, you know, got the prime slot, and I think he's set up pretty well.
Matt Continetti?
Yeah, just going over the list of speakers tonight, it occurred to me how many Republican politicians actually have something to gain from Mitt Romney losing. And you know,
you go from Chris Christie
to Bob McDonald to Rick Santorum. We've met Brian Sandoval of Nevada, Rick Snyder of Michigan, Walker of Wisconsin, much less the Rubios and the Rand Pauls. It is, as Mara said, an extraordinarily deep bench. And all of these guys, I think, are raring to go for the main seat.
2016.
Yeah.
Ron Elving and EJ Dion, last thoughts down there.
Well, first off, it could be 2016. It could be 2020 if Mitt Romney is running.
Right, that's
out
the paradox,
is
that they might actually not
enough.
Get the chance. Yeah,
that's right. They might have to leave a very strong impression. look, there have been over a dozen keynoters who have run for president later on. Only a couple of them have gotten the nomination. That's not necessarily the best position to be in. The position that's most enviable here at this convention for future presidential candidates is Paul Ryan's. He is the VP. He is the guy who's on the ticket. Win or lose in November, he's going to be a very strong contender down the road.
But there happens to be one keynoter who did make it to be president, and he happens to be the president of the United States right now. I mean, Barack Obama made his career with a keynote address at the 2004 convention, which I cannot believe was not on Chris Christie's mind, whatever else he said about President Obama tonight.
So, brief preview tomorrow. What are we? Who are we looking for tomorrow, EJ?
Well, we're going to Paul Ryan tomorrow night. I just wanted to put that out in my Paul Ryan advertisement. He is the key tomorrow night. He's the last guy. But who are you waiting to hear from, EJ?
I'm waiting to hear from Paul Ryan. I mean, I think that one of the striking things about Ryan is that he has had an unbelievably positive treatment until this moment. By the Washington press, by the Washington establishment. This is the first time since he was picked by Romney that he's really been challenged, and his biography has been examined closely, his record has been examined closely. And for a lot of Americans, he's so well-known in Washington, he's not that well-known to Americans outside ideological circles, outside budget debates. And again, I think if Christie sets a high standard for Romney, which I believe he did, he sets a high standard for Ryan tomorrow night.
Well, and we'll be here to hear that. E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution. We've also been joined by NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, national political correspondent Mara Liasson, White House correspondent Ari Shapiro, Matt Continente of the Washington Free Beacon, and Jeff Brady and Brian Naylor on the floor there in Tampa. You have been listening to special coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden.